Edit audio.
On the last episode of the Springfield 3.
A plausible theory at the time was somebody noting that Cheryl's dog wasn't where it should have been, and that perhaps somebody just took the dog out of the yard and knocked on the door and said, "I'm sorry, is this your dog? I found him wandering on Glenstone. I didn't want to get him hit." She's going to be grateful and open the door. And then you're in. And once you're in, you have the upper hand on everything.
My interview with Janice McCall lasted the entire day. We had lunch together, she took a break for a doctor's appointment, and then came back to finish, driving in the pouring rain. During this time in a small room in the local library, Janice received a call on her cell phone. It was from her grandson, who was staying with them at the time, but who was heading out for the evening.
"So what time do you think you'll be home, babe?" "Okay, I would say earlier, 8:30 to 9 would be what I'd want you home, okay? Because of the weather and everything that may come in. Okay? And if you can call me anytime during that time and let me know. Okay? All right. Love you, honey. Bye-bye. Grandson."
She sounded affectionate, like she'd be a really great grandma to have. And it sort of hit me. This disappearance, the disappearance of Janice McCall's daughter, affected everything in her life. Like it's affected Bart Streeter or any family and friends of these women. And though not to the same extent, it's affected everyone who was involved in this case.
"I look at my daughters and they're grown, and you know, my youngest is the same age as Susie was when she disappeared. And I don't know how you could go forward without your life being forever changed. And Susie forever changed my life, and her disappearance forever changed my life. The mother that I am, very overprotective, and very, my kids never got to go stay the night with friends when they were growing up. You know, it was just like I had a hard time letting them out of my sight, knowing again bad things do happen to good people, and that it's not just the bad guys that have problems and drama and pain, right? It's that they carry that over into other people's worlds. I was bound and determined as a mom that I would protect my kids, and I know that as a mom, that was Janice, like, just protecting your kids is a thing that you do. And that the pain of loss when something like that happens is just hard to even comprehend."
"I always wish I would have known them before. What was Janice McCall like before her daughter vanished? And the sort of vibrancy that she would have had within her eyes. Because you would just want to give up. Your beautiful daughter is gone. Through the most highly unlikely circumstances ever, she just vanished, and that she could survive that and move forward is a strength that I'm not sure I have for her alone, if this could be solved. And I think for Springfield too. Would it make people in Springfield at least be relieved? Yes, and I think it would also make them believe that good things can come out of some of the most horrific things that have ever happened in the city's history. It's that sort of terrible marker in history that has to be resolved, just so when it's retold in history, there's proof that good things can win, as opposed to it being a mystery for the ages that's never solved."
This case tells just an incredible story about that community, about a police department that tried with all their might to solve it, with family members that they were ready to have graduation cake the next day. These were people starting their lives, and for it to be just erased, it without anything to point to or anyone to blame, I mean, that is a story that does need to be told, because there are those mysteries out there that will linger. And I think this one has eaten a lot of people up inside.
The This is the Springfield Three, a podcast about the disappearance of three women who forever changed a small Missouri town and the people in it. Throughout this podcast, we followed the disappearance of the Springfield Three, Stacy McCall, Susie Streeter, and Cheryl Levitt. We know that they disappeared in the early hours of June 7th of 1992, and we know that they have not been found. Here's Heather Kohler, who grew up down the street on Delmar.
This Springfield Three is really something that is a big thing in Springfield, you know, and people talk about it, but it's like, if you lived here, you really experienced what it did to this city and what it felt like. And so it was definitely something that I would always talk to people about, you know, and kind of say, oh yeah, you know, I lived on that street, or, you know, I remember this, I remember that. But yeah, I talk about it a lot because it just was such a big deal here. You know, it's the biggest, one of the biggest things that's really happened here. And we have no answers. And it drives me crazy.
These were three women, beloved by so many, that had so much in front of them. And there's a common narrative in this case. It kept coming up. In fact, I'd find it in almost every interview that I conducted. I'd hear the same thing. Things like this just don't happen in Springfield, Missouri.
Let's be real, in 1992 in Springfield, Missouri, you wouldn't think anything like that would happen.
Things like that don't happen in
Because things like that Springfield. Just don't happen in Springfield.
It was a crime that rocked the entire town of Springfield, Missouri, a town in the Ozarks where people left their doors unlocked and crime felt almost non-existent. I was 12 years old at the time the three women disappeared, and overnight, things changed. We started locking our doors for the first time ever, and my mom became worried. If three women could be taken in the middle of the night and the suspect was never found, could he be out there?
Well, it was very frightening. And at first, you think, okay, they're going to find them. Mm-hmm. It may take a week or so, but they're going to figure it out. They're going to find them. Never dreaming that it would go on this long. Years. And you just kept thinking, I mean, everybody was so upset about it in Springfield. Then rumors started floating around, as you know, which is normal, all kinds of rumors that so-and-so did it, because it wasn't being solved right away.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was just so scary and so sad that they never could figure out what happened. And to this day, there are still rumors. It still affects Springfield.
But it wasn't just my mom who was affected by the three missing women. It was everyone in the town. If you were to ask just about anyone in the town about the Springfield Three or the three missing women, they would be able to tell you their names, maybe their ages, and what they looked like. That poster, the bright yellow poster of the three women, is burned in everyone's brain. Here's Barrett Fisk, who we heard from in episode 4 and who grew up in Springfield.
If you're from Springfield, it's the one big case that everybody knows. It's the most famous by far true crime event that's ever happened in Springfield's history ever. And there's nothing else like it. And the whole town has wondered for years what has happened. I mean, some people around the world, you know, are just as curious, but yeah, for those of us who've lived here and kind of lived with the mystery and the unknown, the uncertainty of it. It's one thing that we all thought we would see resolved in our lifetimes, but hasn't really been resolved yet. And I think everyone's a little surprised by that, that there isn't some sort of answer by now, almost 3 decades later.
Coyote Adobe Restaurant and Bar on Glenstone Street, not far from Cheryl and Susie's home on Delmar, still has one of these posters. Worn and torn, but still preserved. The owner, David Bauer, promised Janice that he wouldn't take the posters down until her daughter was found. But you know now that hasn't happened. Stacy, Susie, and Cheryl are still somewhere out there. Since then, time has marched on. The town of Springfield is now more of a city, bleeding into the small towns around it and forming a population of nearly 170,000. But on the outskirts are still the wooded hollows. The lakes still surround the towns, large and small. I still visit Table Rock Lake every summer.
I mean, I think it changed the community initially. I think, you know, people have gotten on with their lives because that's what we do, right?
Janice is now a proud grandmother. When I last spoke to her, she told me about going on a cruise with her husband, Stuart, who she's been married to for over 50 years.
It's nice to have a good family and a close family.
I've kept in contact with Janice throughout this podcast. And while I've not been able to visit due to COVID, we've kept in touch via text. She always asks about my mom and grandma, the ones who live in the apartment down the street from Cox South Hospital. She doesn't know them, but she always asks about my family. Cheryl Levitt and her daughter Susie Streeter were declared dead by the family in 1997. There's a bench dedicated to the three women in Phelps Grove Park.
You know, we have a bench that we all chipped in on, and it's out at Phelps Grove Park, and it's a beautiful bench, but that's not Stacy, Susie, and Cheryl there.
Nigel Holderby, Susie's best friend, has three daughters. One's named Elizabeth, Susie's middle name, and one named Suzanne. She keeps a framed photo of Susie in her home.
Yeah, and I think that over the time that's passed, it's hard to just think of a person, someone just so full of life and just as missing, right? That's just a label that's been kind of attached to all three of these really beautiful women. And then to just think now that when people see their photos or they hear the story, they're just like, oh, it's the three missing women.
Right.
And there's so much more than that.
Bart Streeter has not stopped trying to find out what happened to his mom and sister. Robert Craig Cox, Steve Garrison, Larry Hall, and Gerald Carnahan are all in prison. No one has found the green van, nor dug up the parking lots. And Barrett Fisk, the one who told us about the kids at Camp Winoka, the ones who say they saw and heard the three women that night, has spent hours informing local journalists and law enforcement, both who were on the case prior and now, about his findings.
The authorities, you know, have been in contact on this. This is something that is to their knowledge. What it comes down to, though, is this person doesn't have any other direction to lead us in. They've given us the information they have. They saw what happened. They saw there were three people involved. They saw they were taken away from this place. There's no remains of them there. But that's all the information they have. They don't know who they were. They didn't get that good a look. It was dark. When you realize that the things they are saying in this post are true, you have to realize that all the things they are saying in this post are true. This is not something they ever wanted to bring all this attention to. This is something they felt like they had to share by giving us this deeply personal memory. But nonetheless, it's something we need to know. And it's something that needs to become part of the anthology and the history of the case, because it's just one more little component that's going to lead us closer to getting some type of resolution. And when we can focus on what's important, we can kind of eliminate what's not important.
Reporters who covered the case remain baffled.
I think all of us who had to deal with that story realized this was going to be something that hopefully we'd never see again. But even now, it's coming up on 30 years. And the idea that there is no resolution at all is really bothersome still. Even today, Springfield police have nothing about it. But the level of interest is still curiously high. I mean, do you know of another case where 30 years later, people are still openly swapping theories about what may have happened?
And for some law enforcement, this case ate them up inside.
And I just have never covered a case in my 27 years covering crime off and on, and a lot of times on, that a case mesmerized people like this. And I never have covered a case that baffled police like this. Back in the day, you would hear stories that it really ate up police officers. I've talked to many, I won't name, but that it did eat them up inside. There was trouble at home because they were just all I could think about was the case. I had one source that for many years, and I don't know if he still does, but he kept a picture of them in his wallet. It was just, that just doesn't happen. You know, every cop that I've ever interviewed on retirement, they will say, oh, there's that one case, you know. But I think this was for many officers.
Well, you know, like I said, you think after, you know, a career in law enforcement, you do a lot of things that maybe you wouldn't think about as often, but I do. I think about it. I mean, that's the one thing I'm like, man, you know, I wish this could get solved.
Here's Daryl Moore.
Well, first of all, it stands out because it's one of the few cases that I ever had that has ended up not being resolved yet. And then to the other steam, it's one of the few cases that was well organized and thought out and executed.
But what sticks out most to me was my conversation with David Asher.
The entire case is ever present in my mind every morning. I still have, and I have one sitting right here beside me, the missing folder poster from the day that it was first put out. I still have this. I keep it in my house. I keep it in my computer armoire. Every morning I get up, I think in my mind, this could be the day. This could be the day. And I believe before I die, it will happen, but I'm 76 years old and going to have to hurry up. But I'm confident. We pray about it. We pray for the folks. We pray of all the people involved, including Susie's brother, who was later considered to be a suspect and then eliminated by the other people. There's a lot of people that still call me, and I tell them I'm not working this case. I have it on my mind every day. If I was afforded an opportunity, I would, but I'm not. It turned my hair gray, so I don't know what would happen now. It'd probably just fall out.
The case of the three missing women, or the Springfield Three, is still being worked in hopes to solve it, to bring some sort of resolution to this town.
Of course, there's been a lot done on this case since I left 23 years ago. It's an ongoing case. It's still being worked as valid, and I use that term, valid leads come in. Not just somebody's dream, but they are chasing down the dreams to be sure that the person that's making those calls is not the person responsible, or maybe knows the person responsible. So, you know, those leads are checked out as best they can be.
Sometimes I get the calls because they've given the information to SPD, who's told them, you know, this has already been looked at, it's not true. And then I guess they feel frustrated, so they call me, and I'm going, police department's right, that's just looked at, there's no way it's this guy.
Will this case ever be solved?
Some will say no, not going to happen. Others will say, yeah, I think that it will, but it will be somebody's deathbed confession, or it'll be something in the mail sent to somebody, or, you know, some clue. But I guess I hold out hope that it will. It's really something to say almost 28 years later that I'm not any clearer to knowing what happened that night than, and I've spent many hours studying the case and talking with people, and I really don't know of many officers that think they're any closer. And, you know, so I dearly hope that it is solved. And I know that some people feel that they'll get an answer when they themselves pass away. And, you know, I've talked with family members who will say that. But I hope for the Springfield community's sake as well that it is solved. And I think today, I'm not sure that that's going to happen anytime soon, which is unfortunate.
Sure, absolutely. again, I think it's going to take a confession, but I think that, you know, I think it's possible. I think anything's possible, because whoever did this probably has done other things. And there's always hope. There's always hope that, that this case could be solved. And if it's Cox, you know, I just hope that there's a moment in time that he or realize that it's time to come clean. Because why not? There's been a lot of pain and suffering that's already occurred. People have already suffered, and it would only be a relief. It would only provide a sense of relief for the person who did this to come clean.
That's why I keep saying yes, and that's why I said yes to talk to you. Is it's really, really important to all of us that have been touched by this, that someday we have an understanding, a resolution, a solution, you know, to movement, you know, forward with where we have tried to just keep carrying forward. There's just something so unsettling about the unknown. You really cannot have peace. You really cannot have closure. And closure's a weird word for me to use. It's because it will never, there's not just the end date that, oh, this has happened now, and so now this is closed, right? Because it's with us forever. But closure in the sense that we can move forward with an understanding that we don't have that anymore.
This was supposed to be the last scheduled episode of the Springfield 3, A Small Town Disappearance. But since this podcast was released just 2 short months ago, we've heard from a lot of people. I wrote this series in hopes to introduce the case to a broader audience. And since it's aired, Bart Streeters reached out to me via email, and I really hope to speak with him on record soon. We've received emails about theories. And just today, I received a DM from the daughter of the person who owns the dentist building behind 1717 Delmar Street. And here's what she told me. Her father saw the van on June 6th of 1992, the night the three women disappeared. It was parked on his side of the fence, and he immediately knew it was out of place. During this time, someone had been dumping trash on his side of the fence, and he thought that the people in the van might have something to do with it. So he quickly went inside to grab a pen and paper, hoping to jot down the license plate number. And when he got back outside, they were driving away. Apparently, he saw three men about Cheryl's age, and he saw Cheryl. According to this business owner, they were all laughing and carrying on. He filed a police report, was quickly questioned, and then nothing more. Were those the men that took the women? Was that infamous van parked behind Cheryl's the entire time? Will the Springfield Police Department follow up? Could any of these tips coming into my inbox be the truth? If you have any information about this case, please contact the Springfield Police Department at 417-864-1810. Or if you think we should look into tips, you can email me at aroderickjones@gmail.com or the edit audio team at hello@editaud.io. And please stay subscribed. We'll be updating you. The Springfield 3 is an Edit Audio original production created in collaboration with Anne Roderick Jones. The series is written, researched, and hosted by Anne Roderick Jones. It was produced and edited by Ali Sirois, with executive producing from Steph Colburn, Sophie Shin, and with lots of help from the rest of the amazing Edit Audio team. Theme music was written by Patrick Rindle and Ali Sirois and was produced by Patrick Rindle at Studio Dolly. And thank you to all of those who share their stories with us. This project would not be possible without you.